BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio. Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Hello and welcome to a special Good Friday edition of Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and over the next hour we'll be hearing all sorts of snippets from around the world of internet radio, particularly listening into things that are going on in the United States. Both on YouTube and on internet radio, you can hear all sorts of interesting commentary, some of it the sort of thing that we're not used to hearing here in the UK. Anyway, we'll start off on this special Good Friday edition by hearing from Webster Tarpley at World Crisis Radio. That's Webster Tarpley. He's a historian and author in the United States, and World Crisis Radio. So here we have about 10 minutes from him, and after that there'll be some more.
Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. I'm your host, Webster Tarpley, here in Washington, D.C., and we have a full plate of catastrophic economic developments this week. Let's go to the heart of the matter right at the beginning. This past March 30th was a catastrophic day for the United States. This was the day that Obama, to some degree, dropped his mask, exposed himself more as a puppet of Wall Street intent on destroying the industrial economy of the United States than he had up to now. It is clear, based on Obama's refusal to grant any short-term funds to General Motors and Chrysler, that he is committed to driving the U.S. auto industry into bankruptcy. This is an asset stripping operation at the highest level. This is going to be the greatest fire sale, distressed merchandise sale in recent history. The vultures, the bottom feeders, the asset strippers are looking around. Soros, the Blackstone Group, J.C. Flowers, that guy Wilbur, whatever his name is, are all eyeing the industrial plant and equipment of the American Middle West, and they're thinking about how they can strip it and sell it off. The other side of it, of course, is it's not just the factories that will be destroyed. The United Auto Workers is now on track to get busted by Obama. More than a year ago, I warned on this program, Obama is the strike breaker, the union buster. Obama, his family business is to bust unions. That is what American foundations do, the Ford, the Annenberg, the Gates, the Broad, and so forth. And along with his commitment to destroy the teachers' union and public sector unionism, Obama is committed to bust the United Auto Workers, the most militant traditionally of the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, trade unions coming out of the 1930s and eventually merging with the AFL-CIO. But with the UAW can be destroyed, then all the others can be destroyed, be they the steel workers, the electrical workers, and so on down the line. That is the goal of this operation. Drive General Motors and Chrysler into bankruptcy as soon as possible, asset strip them, and bust the United Auto Workers. Because, of course, when you go into bankruptcy, then the labor contract gets thrown out the window, and you'll have a reactionary to fascist judge sitting there as the bankruptcy administrator, some Bush appointee, no doubt, who will lick his chops and say, now is the chance to destroy trade unionism here in the United States. Notice, of course, though, when AIG is in trouble, those contracts are sacrosanct. The contracts under which AIG gave all those hundreds of millions of dollars of bonuses, and of course, Bank of America gave billions, and Citigroup gave billions, and Merrill Lynch gave billions of TARP money, taxpayer money, to their parasitical, incompetent, bungling, greedy corporate officials. Of course, that's sacrosanct. But then when it comes to the labor contract at General Motors or Chrysler with the UAW, and indeed the UAW of the auto workers of Canada now, that is expendable. So this is the duplicity. Now, we've talked here about what should happen to auto. These plants have got to be nationalized. You have got to preserve at all costs those assembly lines, those workers, that accumulated buildup of experience and productive capability, above all the machine tool capability. The tool and die capability that is built into the auto industry is an absolutely indispensable national asset, and it means that the machine tool capability that depends on Detroit is absolute key to national survival. It is, of course, also a resource for humanity as a whole. The one thing you can say about the Detroit factories is reconvert those factories, they can lift the world. So nationalize them. Act under the Defense Production Act and other relevant legislation to say, since we have this wonderful national emergency bequeathed to us by Bush the Younger, seize General Motors, seize Chrysler. In the case of Chrysler, get Cerberus Hedge Fund out of the picture. Those are raptors. Those are the people who have driven Chrysler into the ground. Chrysler is a perfectly viable firm, in many ways showing a flair for creativity in some of their designs. They can be reconverted. General Motors, same thing. And, of course, here the amount of productive capability is even larger. What you want to do, of course, is to remove people like Nardelli, who have been put in there by Chrysler, who don't come from the auto industry, have no idea of what they're doing, or essentially dancing to the tune of Wall Street. Now, in the case of Wagoner, the obvious thing with Wagoner is that here was somebody who, whatever else he was undoubtedly devoted to General Motors. Maybe there was a danger that he would fight to save General Motors from being broken up and fed into the jaws of these sharks. In other words, stop General Motors from being asset-stripped, broken up, and destroyed. He might even had an idea that productive labor is essential, although that's very rare. So Obama, acting with unbelievable arrogance, and indeed illegal, acting in the logic of the fascist corporate state, because that's what this is now, Obama drives out Wagoner because, I believe, Wagoner was somebody who might have put up some resistance. He might have fought back. He might have said, Barkey, no, you're not going to destroy 120 years of productive capability that we've been able to put together here on the banks of the Great Lakes. Well, Wagoner is now gone. Notice the double standard. Notice the hypocrisy. Here's where you really see Obama's mission. AIG is in trouble. They need $40 billion. They get it right away. No questions asked. J.P. Morgan Chase, they're in trouble. They need money under the TARP, under the original $700 billion rescue. They get $20 billion for themselves and $20 billion for the fact that they're absorbing Bear Stearns. Same story with Citibank. They've been refinanced three times. They're into the U.S. government for $40 billion U.S. dollars. Bank of America, similar, $20 to $25 billion. Wells Fargo, Wachovia, $20 billion. They don't have to show viability. They don't have to show that they can reconvert. They don't have to show anything. They snap their fingers. The money is delivered at the midnight on Saturday night, so that the publicity will be as little as possible. Notice now how these industrial managers, whoever they are, right, the Nardellis, the Wagoners, and so forth, they are made to jump through hoops. They have to wear sackcloth and ashes and so forth. This is obviously symbolism, but it's a symbolism that says, in Obama's world, as I have argued here repeatedly for more than a year, in Obama's world, there's only one interest that counts: Wall Street, Wall Street, Wall Street. Derivatives, 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 hedge funds, hedge funds, hedge funds, the raptors, lampreys, ticks, and you know the drill. At the same time, industrial employment, industrial production is viewed as something undesirable. It's important to get rid of it. Obama has this vision of the gangrene economy dancing in front of his eyes. Of course, it's put there by Holdridge, the de-development fiend, the austerity ghoul and gangrene economy expert who sits in the White House as a science advisor. The science advisor in the White House for Obama is someone who hates science and is determined to destroy science and discredit it. So that's what's going on at that level. So the goal here is to exalt the interest of Wall Street. And we know the arithmetic is that under Obama, given the fact that he was an endorser and supporter and organizer of the first bailout, the TARP, back in October, it's $10 trillion to $11 trillion for the banks, and if we're lucky, one-third of a trillion for any productive use or popular development for the American people. We'll be back in a minute.
Well, that was Webster Tarpley's comment on modern events, current affairs, as he sees it, a bit of doom and gloom. Now we move over to have a look at an ex-CBS producer, Bill Moyers. Bill was left CBS back in the 1980s, and since then he's set up something called the Center for Public Integrity. As a current affairs producer, he decided that he couldn't really do what he wanted to do within CBS, so he set up a sort of independent production company. Now he's working for the Public Broadcasting Network, that's PBS in the United States, and if you want to find out more about Bill and his various guests, go to www.pbs.org/Moyers. Anyway, here he is talking about the banking crisis, and he's talking here to an ex-bank regulator.
Welcome to the Journal. For months now, revelations of the wholesale greed and blatant transgressions of Wall Street have reminded us that the best way to rob a bank is to own one. In fact, the man you're about to meet wrote a book with just that title. It was based upon his experience as a tough regulator during one of the darkest chapters in our financial history, the savings and loan scandal in the late 1980s.
These numbers, as very large as they are, vastly understate the problem of fraud.
Bill Black was in New York this week for a conference at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, where scholars and journalists gathered to ask the question, how do they get away with it? Well, no one has asked that question more often than Bill Black. The former director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention now teaches economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. During the savings and loan crisis, it was Black who accused then House Speaker Jim Wright and five U.S. senators, including John Glenn and John McCain, of doing favors for the SNLs in exchange for contributions and other perks. The senators got off with a slap on the wrist, but so enraged was one of those bankers, Charles Keating, after whom the Senate's so-called Keating Five were named, he sent a memo that read in part, "Get Black, kill him dead." Metaphorically, of course. Of course. Now he's focused on an even greater scandal, and he spares no one, not even the president he worked hard to elect, Barack Obama. But his main target are the Wall Street barons who are heirs of an earlier generation whose scandalous ripoffs of wealth back in the 1930s earned them comparison to Al Capone and the mob, and the nickname, banksters. Bill Black, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you.
I was taken with your candor at the conference here in New York to hear you say that this crisis we're going through, this economic and financial meltdown, is driven by fraud. What's your definition of fraud?
Fraud is deceit. And the essence of fraud is I create trust in you, and then I betray that trust and get you to give me something of value. And as a result, there's no more effective acid against trust than fraud, especially fraud by top elites, and that's what we have.
In your book, you make it clear that calculated dishonesty by people in charge is at the heart of most large corporate failures and scandals, including, of course, the SNL. But is that true? Is that what you're saying here, that it was in the boardrooms and the CEO offices where this fraud began?
Absolutely.
How did they do it? What do you mean?
Well, the way that you do it is to make really bad loans because they pay better. Then you grow extremely rapidly. In other words, you're a Ponzi-like scheme. And the third thing you do is we call it leverage. That just means borrowing a lot of money. And the combination creates a situation where you have guaranteed record profits in the early years. That makes you rich through the bonuses that its modern executive compensation has produced. It also makes it inevitable that there's going to be a disaster down the road.
So you're suggesting or saying that CEOs of some of these banks and mortgage firms, in order to increase their own personal income, deliberately set out to make bad loans?
Yes.
How do they get away with it? I mean, what about their own checks and balances in the company? What about their accounting divisions?
All of those checks and balances report to the CEO. So if the CEO goes bad, all of the checks and balances are easily overcome. And the art form is not simply to defeat those internal controls, but to suborn them, to turn them into your greatest allies. And the bonus programs are exactly how you do that.
If I wanted to go looking for the parties to this with a good bird dog, where would you send me?
Well, that's exactly what hasn't happened. We haven't looked, right? The Bush administration essentially got rid of regulation. So if nobody was looking, you were able to do this with impunity, and that's exactly what happened. Where would you look? You'd look at the specialty lenders, the lenders that did almost all of their work in the subprime and what's called Alt A, liar's loans.
Liar's loans. Why did they call them liar's loans?
Because they were liar's loans.
And they knew it?
They knew it. They knew that they were frauds. Liar's loans mean that we don't check. You tell us what your income is, you tell us what your job is, you tell us what your assets are, and we agree to believe you. We won't check on any of those things. And by the way, you get a better deal if you inflate your income and your job history and your assets.
You think they really said that to borrowers?
We know that they said that to borrowers. In fact, they were also called in the trade ninja loans.
Ninja?
Because no income verification, no job verification, no asset verification.
You're talking about significant American companies.
Huge. One company produced as many losses as the entire savings and loan debacle.
Which company?
IndyMac, specialized in making liar's loans. In 2006 alone, it sold $80 billion of liar's loans to other companies. $80 billion.
And was this happening exclusively in this subprime mortgage business?
No, and that's a big part of the story as well. Even prime loans began to have non-verification. Even Ronald Reagan, you know, said trust but verify.
Right.
They just gutted the verification process. We know that will produce enormous fraud under economic theory, criminology theory, and 2,000 years of life experience.
Is it possible that these complex instruments were deliberately created so swindlers could exploit them?
Oh, absolutely. This stuff, the exotic stuff that you're talking about, was created out of things like liar's loans that were known to be extraordinarily bad. And now it was getting AAA ratings. Now, a AAA rating is supposed to mean there is zero credit risk. So you take something that not only has significant, it has crushing risk. That's why it's toxic. And you create this fiction that it has zero risk. That itself, of course, is a fraudulent exercise. And again, there was nobody looking during the Bush years. So finally, only a year ago, we started to have a congressional investigation of some of these rating agencies. And it's scandalous what came out. What we know now is that the rating agencies never looked at a single loan file. When they finally did look, after the markets had completely collapsed, they found, and I'm quoting Fitch, the smallest of the rating agencies, the results were disconcerting in that there was the appearance of fraud in nearly every file we examined.
So if your assumption is correct, your evidence is sound, the bank, the lending company, created a fraud, and the ratings agency that is supposed to test the value of these assets knowingly entered into the fraud. Both parties are committing fraud by intention.
Right, and the investment banker that we call it pooling puts together these bad mortgages, the liar's loans, and creates the toxic waste of these derivatives. All of them do that. And then they sell it to the world, and the world just thinks that because it has a AAA rating, it must actually be safe. Well, instead, there are 60 and 80% losses on these things because, of course, in reality, they are toxic waste.
You're describing what Bernie Madoff did to a limited number of people, but you're saying it's systemic, a systemic Ponzi scheme.
Oh, Bernie was a piker. He doesn't even get into the front ranks of a Ponzi scheme.
But you're saying our system became a Ponzi scheme.
Our system
became financial system.
A Ponzi scheme. Everybody was buying a pig in the poke, but they were buying a pig in a poke with a pretty pink ribbon, and the pink ribbon said AAA.
Is there a law against liar's loan?
Not directly, but there are, of course, many laws against fraud, and liar's loans are fraudulent.
Because?
Because they're not going to be repaid and because they have false representations. They involve deceit, which is the essence of fraud.
Why is it so hard to prosecute? Why hasn't anyone been brought to justice over this?
Because they didn't even begin to investigate the major lenders until the market had actually collapsed, which is completely contrary to what we did successfully in the savings and loan crisis, right? Even while the institutions were reporting they were the most profitable savings and loan in America, we knew they were frauds and we were moving to close them down. Here, the Justice Department, even though it very appropriately warned in 2004 that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud. The FBI publicly warned in September 2004 that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud, that if it was allowed to continue, it would produce a crisis at least as large as the savings and loan debacle, and that they were going to make sure that they didn't let that happen. So what goes wrong? First thing that goes wrong is after 9/11, the attacks, the Justice Department transfers 500 white-collar specialists in the FBI to national terrorism. We can all understand that, but then the Bush administration refused to replace the missing 500 agents. So even today, again, as you say, this crisis is 1,000 times worse, perhaps, certainly 100 times worse than the savings and loan crisis. There are 1/5 as many FBI agents as worked the savings and loan crisis.
You talk about the Bush administration. Of course, there's that famous photograph of some of the regulators in 2003 who come to a press conference with a chainsaw suggesting that they're going to slash, cut business loose from regulation, right?
Well, they succeeded. And in that picture, by the way, the other three of the other guys with pruning shears are the
that's right.
They're the trade representatives. They're the lobbyists for the bankers. And everybody's grinning. The government's working together with the industry to destroy regulation. Well, we now know what happens when you destroy regulation. You get the biggest financial calamity of anybody under the age of 80.
But I can point you to statements by Larry Summers, who was then Bill Clinton's Secretary of the Treasury, or the other Clinton Secretary of the Treasury, Rubin. I can point you to suspects in both parties, right?
There were two really big things under the Clinton administration. One, they got rid of the law that came out of the real-world disasters of the Great Depression. We learned a lot of things in the Great Depression, and one is we had to separate what's called commercial banking from investment banking. That's a Glass-Steagall law. But we thought we were much smarter, supposedly, so we got rid of that law, and that was bipartisan. And the other thing is we passed a law because there was a very good regulator, Brooksley Bourne, that everybody should know about, probably doesn't. She tried to do the right thing to regulate one of these exotic derivatives that you're talking about. We call them CDS. And Summers, Rubin, and Phil Graham came together to say not only will we block this particular regulation, we will pass a law that says you can't regulate. And it's this type of derivative that is most involved in the AIG scandal. And AIG all by itself cost the same as the entire savings and loan debacle.
What did AIG contribute? What did they do wrong?
They made bad loans. Their type of loan was to sell a guarantee, right? And they charged a lot of fees up front. So they booked a lot of income, paid enormous bonuses. The bonuses we're thinking about now, they're much smaller than these bonuses that were also the product of accounting fraud. And they got very, very rich. But of course, then they had guaranteed this toxic waste, these liar's loans. Well, we've just gone through why those toxic waste, those liar's loans, are going to have enormous losses. And so you have to pay the guarantee on those enormous losses, and you go bankrupt. Except that you don't in the modern world, because you come to the United States and the taxpayers play the fool under Secretary Geithner and under Secretary Paulson before him. We took $5 billion, for example, in U.S. taxpayer money and sent it to a huge Swiss bank called UBS at the same time that that bank was defrauding the taxpayers of America. And we were bringing a criminal case against them. We eventually get them to pay a $780 million fine, but wait, we gave them $5 billion. So the taxpayers of America paid the fine of a Swiss bank. And why are we bailing out somebody that is defrauding us?
And why?
How mad is this?
What is your explanation for why the bankers who created this mess are still calling the shots?
Bill Moyers doing the interviewing there at www.pbs.org/Moyers, talking there to an ex-bank regulator. And we'll be hearing more from that in the next couple of weeks. Actually, Drive Time next Friday, there's a special outside broadcast. But we'll be back with the second half of that interview afterwards. And if you want to hear on the internet, there's plenty of... you can hear the tail end of that interview anytime you want to. Just tune in to www.pbs.org/Moyers, and also if you search for Bill Moyers and banking crisis on YouTube, you'll find that interview there too. On many of these American internet radios and broadcasts over in the States, there are some quite interesting adverts, not the sort of thing we're used to hearing here in Britain. So here's one now from, and this is from Mike Rivero. And here's What Really Happened Radio. In fact, there's quite a lot of radio channels you can hear this particular advert on, but I thought I'd let you have a listen because it's not the sort of thing we're used to hearing here in the UK.
The new World Order Beast is genetically modifying your food.
Genetically modifying.
Mixing vegetables with animals. And now experimenting with viruses.
Viruses.
Without a long-term food solution,
without a long-term,
you will have just two options. Starve or surrender.
Surrender.
All canned food supplies will eventually run out.
What then?
Then. Grow your own healthy food and feed your family forever. SurvivalistSeeds.com is now the nation's largest bulk heirloom seed company.
And it's owned by a real patriot,
Big John Lipscomb.
You can now have
an infinite amount of healthy vegetables like a watermelon, a bundle of carrots, or tomatoes for a little more than a penny each. SurvivalistSeeds.com. And now you can go into business with Big John at SurvivalistSeeds.com by becoming an affiliate. See his link at SurvivalistSeeds.com.
SurvivalistSeeds.com.
That was a special little advert from American Internet Radio, just to get an idea of the sort of stuff they're listening to in the States. And that was actually an excerpt from Mike Rivero's What Really Happened Radio. And you can hear Mike Rivero at www.whatreallyhappened.com. Mike is an ex-Hollywood film producer, and just as a special treat, we're going to hear now his kind of take on gun control. Over in America, they have very different attitudes to guns to what we have here. Obviously, it's part of their constitution, the right to bear arms. And you can see what's happening at the moment is that as they're losing confidence in the federal government, various people are now... apparently, there's a big upsurge in the purchase of guns and ammunition in the States. So here is Mike, amongst other things, talking about the Wild West.
Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome to our show today. It is Wednesday, hump day, middle of the week, coasting through. What a busy news day. It is just insane out there, and it just feels like things are spinning further and further out of control. Let's get the Dow stuff just done and over with. It ended up 45 points. It was all over the place, bouncing around. A lot of volatility. A little bit in the green at the end of the day, and people are kind of celebrating. But the important thing is that more and more writers, more and more financial reporters and experts, including the New York Times, are now admitting that this Geithner plan is just going to dump billions and billions, potentially trillions of dollars of debt onto the taxpayers, that it is just wide open to gaming and looting by the banks and financial institutions. This is what we have been telling you for weeks now is going on out there. And now the corporate media is catching on to the thing. Everybody knows that's what's going on, and yet they're not going to stop it, and they're not going to change it. Folks, they've got you by the short and curlies, and they're yanking as hard as they can, and the only people who are going to stop it are going to be you. Now, before we get into the rest of the news, a story that's just now breaking, this is coming out of Florida, and it's another tragedy. There's been another shooting, and this one is interesting. This actually took place on a gun range with video surveillance. They got it on tape. This woman was there shooting with her son. Everything seemed to be fine, and all of a sudden she turns and points her gun at the back of her own son's head and pulls the trigger. Then she turns the gun on herself. Apparently, her thinking was that she was the Antichrist, and that she wanted to make sure her son was sent to heaven, because it looked to her like we were at the end times. Now, we are already seeing on some of these TV networks that they're saying, oh, this is more proof that guns have got to be banned and guns have got to be, you know, and all the rest of this situation. But folks, I mean, let's be honest here. What's going on is this woman is a nut. She's crazy. She's a nut. And they're saying in the news, she's been under treatment. This is probably another one of these cases where the antidepressants are out there. And she's operating in the real world with this fantasy, from the religious mythologies that has been drummed into her head. And she's bought into it hook, line, and sinker. And it is a reminder of the wisdom of the old phrase, if you can be taught to believe in absurdities, you can be convinced to commit atrocities. And that's exactly what happened. In her mind, where she is the Antichrist and her son is in risk of not going to heaven, which is a very desirable situation in this particular mythology, it's perfectly acceptable to plug him in the back of the head. The Inquisitors, who set fire to living people during the Inquisition, including some of my ancestors, were convinced by their biblical faith that they were actually doing a kindness to these people, that it was actually a beneficial thing to do, to set fire to them while they were still alive and watch them burn to death. It's just insane. We're at the edge of the third millennium, the 21st century, and we're still seeing people walking around with these ideas in their head. And today it has had a tragic, tragic consequence. Although they're still not saying anything about it, but I tend to view that more than likely this tragedy was pharmacologically enhanced. We know there is a strong correlation between these mood-altering drugs, especially the SSRIs, that and teen suicides and random acts of violence, and it seems like it. The other situation, of course, is I mentioned yesterday, I've gone back through the FBI supplementary crime statistics, and this kind of stuff tragically does happen all the time, but it seems to be reported preferentially today. And the reason is, it looks like the gun grabbers are going to come back for another try. Now, interestingly enough, just before all these mass shootings in New York and Pittsburgh and all the rest of it, the Gallup poll had showed support for gun control was definitely on the wane in the United States, probably because everybody recognizes we've got a dictatorship now, and the best way to deter dictators, as Thomas Jefferson said, is to have an armed public. So all of a sudden, you know, and this is the same situation we had at Columbine, where Colorado was about to pass a concealed carry ban. There had been success with concealed carry across the country. Every time concealed carry was legalized, crime would drop in that area. And for the anti-gun, or as I call them, the pro-crime crew, this was bad news. And Columbine happened right when they needed it to reverse the trend, to get Colorado to say, no, we can't have concealed carry. This is a terrible, terrible thing. And sure enough, the Gallup poll shows support for a gun ban comes on, and all of a sudden we're having all these gun crimes show up. And especially in Binghamton, New York, where we had two guys removed from the building in handcuffs, and then they just go away from the story. And we're told it was a lone, crazed lone nut, registered trademark, U.S. government, and he committed suicide, so we can't find out what's going on, and that's the end of the story. And then we have the situation in Pittsburgh, which they're trying to say, oh, the shooter was a reader of those conspiracy websites, and they put him up to it, and blah, 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 blah. Now, when this all started happening a few days ago, I made an observation, both here on the radio show, and to my readers at whatreallyhappened.com, and I said, what these mass shootings are proving is not that guns are dangerous, but that the police rarely, rarely, if ever, show up in time to prevent one of these crimes, whether it's Columbine, Virginia Tech, Binghamton, whatever. The cops can't get there in time. We really don't have pre-crime yet, all the pretenses to the contrary notwithstanding. Pittsburgh showed that even when the cops are there, they may not do a very good job. And I said, so all of these mass shootings are arguing that we need an armed populace to take care of itself. And apparently this message was picked up. It went viral. It went all over the country on blogs and gun rights groups and all the rest of it, because they've run another poll since the Pittsburgh and Binghamton shootings and found that the shootings did not have any effect on support for gun ban. Gun sales are up, ammunition sales are up, people are arming themselves. And it's not just because of the increased crime that comes during hard economic times. It's also because they're seeing the government move towards gun control and gun ban. We've got this thing about all ammunition has to have serial numbers on it that's due out in the middle of summer, which is going to drive the cost of ammunition into the stratosphere, in order to limit the ability of people to purchase ammunition for self-defense, home defense, practice shooting, you know, chasing the revenue is away from the still, what have you. So there's this huge push because our government is seeing what's happening in Moldova and Thailand and Greece and Iceland, and they know it's coming to happen here. It's probably going to build to a head in summer because some of these banks, despite billions and trillions of taxpayer dollars, they look to be collapsing. And now, even like I said, even the New York Times is admitting this is all a scam. They're looting the public treasury to give to the banks. They're impoverishing the people. They're sticking us with all this unpayable debt. It has gotten so bad, Moody's has literally downgraded the entire country. Every municipal government in the United States has been placed on negative outlook by the Moody's rating agency. Now, the federal government still has a AAA rating, only because it's got 300 million slaves ready to work themselves to death to repay whatever loans it's going to take out. But the rest of the economy, the municipal economies, they're all being downgraded. And that is a red warning sign. The money's flowing in the wrong direction. Instead of getting it back to the people so we can buy stuff and make payments on everything, they're just pulling more and more money away from us. And it's just, it's exactly the wrong thing. And it's building to a head, and the government knows there's going to be a problem and there's going to be resistance. They're trying to find some way they can get you to give up your guns or justify a gun ban and gun confiscation. As we mentioned yesterday, Diane Sawyer on ABC this Friday is going to be doing a segment on her show in which they're going to try and convince you that ordinary citizens with guns really aren't trained to deal with these kind of drastic situations. They're going to try and convince you you really can't take care of yourself even with a gun, so you'd better rely on the police. We got to take a break here right now. If you want to join us on the air, 800-259-9231. Donovan's in the control room. We'll continue on this topic after these words from our sponsors.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here. You're listening to GCN. The Genesis Communication Radio Network.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. We're talking about this story that was just breaking at the start of the show. Tragic, tragic shooting incident down in Florida, caught on videotape and being played all over and being pounded on by the gun grabbers saying, see, this proves guns are bad. For those of you just tuning in right now, the short version is that this woman was at the gun range practicing with her son, convinced she was the Antichrist, wanted her son to go to heaven, turned and shot him in the head, and then shot herself. So that's where we are right now. I am of the opinion, I have, there's no information to support this yet, but I am of the opinion that more than likely, given that she had a prior history of mental problems, that she may have been on antidepressants or SSRIs, because there does seem to be a very strong correlation between these mood-altering chemicals and some of these random acts of violence and teen suicide and so forth. But getting back to the situation, the push is on. We know that the Obama administration came into office wanting stricter gun control, wanting tighter gun control. Never mind that in most of these large cases of these mass shootings, they're already using weapons that are illegal. Or there are, you know, the laws we have aren't being enforced. The answer is always, let's create a new law. Let's create a new law. And we have all these laws that are not being enforced to prevent these situations. But the bottom line is, and my position is, that all of these mass shootings are absolutely proof the police are never going to show up in time to deal with a crime. You've got to do it yourself, and the government has to let you have the means to deal with it yourself. Now, Diane Sawyer is taking an alternate approach. On Friday, they're running a segment on ABC to basically say that ordinary citizens lack the training to be able to handle themselves in a situation like this. Now, that, of course, is very, very presumptive. What ABC is basically doing is saying you're all idiots and you're all too stupid to be able to handle a firearm, and therefore we should take guns away from you and give them to the people like the police. who actually didn't do a very good job of it in Pittsburgh, I would like to point out here. So they're going out here. And as I said yesterday, I have no objection if a requirement to purchase a firearm is a gun safety course. I have no objection to that at all. And if you want to learn combat shooting, get into paintball. Great way to learn how to handle a firearm under the stress of an actual combat situation. But that's not the point. Study after study has shown that when your population is carrying concealed weapons, they don't have to pull them out and use them, usually. The mere awareness that a neighborhood is carrying weapons or has weapons lowers crime. Every one of these mass shootings that you've seen, they have gone into places where they knew nobody would be able to defend themselves. After the Virginia Tech shooting, they were talking about, oh, we've got to have a gun ban on campuses. Virginia Tech had a gun ban on campus. There was already a gun ban there, and everybody was disarmed. All the targets were absolutely helpless. The shooter isn't paying attention to the gun ban, and he was there and armed for the teeth. By the time the cops show up, it's already over. So they're trying to sell you this idea. You're too stupid to take care of yourself. You've got to rely on Big Daddy government to protect you from yourself, and you've got to surrender your guns, which is going to make organized crime very happy. Okay, the phone lines are loading up. We got a bunch of callers. So let's go to Jeff in Texas. Aloha, Jeff. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Michael. All the craziness in the news notwithstanding, I wanted to share with the audience, I think, a very useful tool out on the web for mapping personal relationships and social networks to corporations and government organizations. It's called Muckety, as in, Muckety Mucks, M-U-C-K-E-T-Y, Muckety.com, and you can go and add in any person or corporation and search, and it'll bring up a nice spider-like social network. And so if I were to put in Blackwater, I could go see that this mercenary firm is now called XE, and I can see who the board of directors are, who they're related to, who they used to, what boards they used to serve on. It's really a powerful tool.
Oh, well, I will definitely put that up at the end of the show, and I can already imagine all kinds of things I'm going to try on that as well. And so it's Muckety.com, correct?
That's right.
All right, we'll give that a try. Thanks an awful lot for the phone call, Jeff, and we'll put it up at whatreallyhappened.com after the show. We're going to switch to Richard in Texas. Aloha, Richard. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Mike. I'm just calling about the gun thing you were talking about a little while ago. I was just going to say, let's not forget about this stuff could all be staged the same way they stage things for us to get to war about this. Someone's freaking out with a gun, and now we got to anti-guns. It's a coercion into getting us to get rid of our Second Amendment right to bear arms because a few people went off their rocker. You know what I mean? We're talking millions of a fraction of people that are going off on their rocker compared to 250 million people in this country. I mean, give us a break. People need to wake up and realize that that's our only protection against this government is our right to bear arms.
Oh, that's the reason we have the Second Amendment. I mean, it's not about hunting and it's not about sports shooting. It says right in the Second Amendment, security of a free state. Obviously, the weapons that are reserved to the individual Americans to keep and bear are military arms equal to those the government itself possesses. That was the intent of the Founding Fathers. Thomas Jefferson wrote,
that's right.
The reason for the Second Amendment is to resist tyranny in government. We're all under a lot of stress and financial pressure right now. And as far as staged events, of course that's possible. As I was saying earlier in the show, we have this story about two guys were taken out of the Binghamton Civic Center in handcuffs. It was reported on all the TV, and then all of a sudden, those two guys are gone. It is non-operational. They're just not part of the story anymore. It's a lone gunman, and he died on the scene, so we have no recourse to find out what was really going on. We saw the same thing in Columbine. There was talk of a third shooter, even a fourth and a fifth one. I remember there was one guy who was taken out in handcuffs, and he went away. He vanished from the story. And so,
well,
yeah.
What about the two guys that were in Baghdad that were part of the SAS, British SAS, and they were posing as Taliban, shooting civilians?
Yeah, and the police, and shooting the police. Yeah, that
exactly.
was...
Exactly.
Yeah, they do stuff like that all the time.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the same thing. You know what I mean? People, they could just be sending people out there, hopped up on Prozac like they say they are, you know, and saying that they're the reasons why we need to get rid of our guns. But all I know is just that we need to remember all right. You know, I think you're doing a great job with this show.
Well,
I love
thank you very much. Thank you. And, yeah, the government plays dirty. We know that from COINTELPRO. That's probably the biggest secret the government can no longer keep is they play dirty. And now everybody knows it. They're aware of it. They're prepared for it. And, Richard, we're going to let you go here because we've got a lot of other callers on the line. We're going to switch over to Randy in California. Aloha, Randy. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind today?
Mike, how are you today? The previous gentleman who just called, I'm on the same side of that event that happened at the shooting range. It was pretty horrible. And, you know, there's no doubt that that the mainstream media is hyping up the gun situation to the extreme. And they're covering any time somebody pulls the trigger anywhere, it's on the news. And I just wanted to use this analogy. You know, the government, you know, if they, to control guns, you know, people kill people. It's not guns, okay? And here's my analogy. Cars, okay? Cars kill more people in the United States than probably any other
okay,
industry.
Okay, Randy,
I'm not really
Randy,
sure.
Hold that thought. Randy, hold that thought. Stick with us through the commercial break. I want to bring you back, and we come into the next segment. This is the What Really Happened radio show. I'm your host, Mike Rivero. The phone number is 800-259-9231, and we will be right back.
That was Mike Rivero from whatreallyhappened.com radio. And he's talking there about gun control and various other things to do with the financial bailout, but particularly about the what he sees as big media scare tactics to get people to give up their constitutional rights. We've been hearing exclusively from the United States on this special Good Friday drive time, so let's go a little bit closer to home now. And this is Peter O'Bourne. He's a Daily Mail columnist talking about the British political system.
When I went into political reporting 20, 15 years ago, I thought that MPs went in to serve the public good. What I came to realise, the core thing which happened in the House of Commons was not opposition, but collusion. The MPs of rival parties have far more in common with each other than they have in common with ordinary members of the public, that in fact they are, to a large extent, engaged in a conspiracy against the public. I'll give you an example. When Jackie Smith was caught up in her expenses controversy a few weeks ago, which looked very odd to ordinary members of the public, when she went into Home Office questions, and the Home Secretary took questions, there wasn't a single question from the Tory opposition or from the Liberal Democrats about her very peculiar expenses arrangements. And that is because attacking either party on expenses issues is like using an area weapon, i.e. it's going to destroy or kill off personnel on both sides. Labour now no longer would attack a Tory who's bent because there's too much at stake. If you go back a generation or two, people who came into the Commons, whether from the left or the right, the primary objective was to serve the country or to serve their voters, not to make money for themselves. What is new is that the majority of people now coming into Parliament have sought politics as a career since leaving universities. And therefore, what we see is the use of the House of Commons, use of MPs' alliances, the use of political connections as a way of making a huge sum of money. Very interesting to watch what happens to former ministers. Let's have a look at Tony Blair. You know, he's gone off to work for an American investment bank. He earns millions of pounds of money for that, giving very high-level consultancy about how to link business and politics. John Major, Blair's predecessor, joined the Carlyle Group, a very, very secretive, little-known organisation linked to the Bush family, whose whole sort of raison d'etre is to make money out of government privatisations and contracts. What it does is to cast doubt about the real integrity and independence of the advice these people are doing in office, because the people they're dealing with in office then come and give them jobs, incredibly well-paid jobs, afterwards. The political class funds party political activity in a completely different way to the system which prevailed after World War II, because parties can't go to mass members anymore. There is one way they can use fund money is by basically using that access to the process of government and selling that to interested parties in the business world. You go to the annual conference of the governing party, it's much more like a corporate away day than a party conference. And so businessmen who want to acquire access to the Prime Minister can get it, but they have to pay for it. And you get the emergence of these rather sinister figures lauded in the press, never exposed, these people who broker. They broker between big business and the politicians. And they fix deals. I'll name them. I don't know if you have the to put this on air. Just maybe two or three others in London do handle a lot of this business of brokering, normally or often secret or very private deals between very senior and rich businessmen and their political clans.
Peter Oborne there, Daily Mail columnist, talking about the British political system. It's coming up towards 6 o'clock, and that's just about all we've got time for this week. We're taking a break on Friday Drive Time next week because there's a special outside broadcast, but we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'm Tony Gosling, and this has been the Drive Time Good Friday Special. See you in 2 weeks' time.